Welcome to FemLead, the podcast on female leadership and role models. Prepare to feel inspired and better equipped to navigate your career path. I am Alexandra Chabotaru, your host, and together with my guests, we will tackle a new field of work in each episode. The aim of this podcast is to deep dive into career perspectives and strategies to navigate your desired path for success. Enjoy! Hello all, and welcome to a new episode of FemLead. Season 2 is close to an end, and I'm so happy to hear your feedback about the topics that we cover with our amazing guests. Well, prepare yourselves, as today we discuss growth marketing. Yes, marketing, there we go. We are finally at this step. My next guest is an entrepreneur at heart, product marketeer, and team builder with more than 12 years of experience, 10 of them in tech. She spent the last 3 years with Revolut, where she joined as country manager for Romania in early 2018 and grew the local market from 20,000 users to almost 1.5 million users. She then built Revolut's growth machine, led the growth teams in Central and Eastern Europe, and later on their global growth department, shaping Revolut's growth journey from 1 million to 15 million users globally. Wow, what an accomplishment. Before joining forces with Revolut, she has been leading the marketing efforts of Uber in Romania, shaping the local strategy and working on strategic regional projects and initiatives. During her time at Uber, she launched 3 cities, scaled to market 1 million users, and built the marketing team from scratch. She's a global citizen that has been living, studying, and working in 7 cities across Europe and the United States. She speaks 4 foreign languages, and she's the mom of a hyperactive toddler. Welcome our amazing guest for today, Irina Scarlat. Irina, welcome. It's such an honor to have you here.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's an honor for me to be here.
Thank you so much. We finally found this time to put together 1 hour of chatting and discussing your amazing career. How are you today? How is life for you looking these days?
Fine. It's quite peaceful, given that I'm now on a sabbatical. So I'm taking life slower than usual these days. Traveling a lot, enjoying more time with the family, reading a lot, trying to write. Not managing to write too much because my toddler has a passion in interrupting me. But it's good. It's very, very good.
I'm happy to hear that. You've shared your journey with us online. And of course, I've known about your sabbatical as well, which is also one of the reasons why we can have an hour now and discuss a bit more in depth to your career, which I'm very excited about. So let's deep dive into marketing. And what is growth marketing to start with? What does it mean to work in growth marketing?
So I think that's a very good question. And I think that if you ask 5 persons what growth is, you're going to get 5 different answers. So I'm going to give you my own definition of growth. And for me, growth means growing a product all along the funnel. So that means user acquisition, acquiring new users to use your service. That means conversion to active users and to paid users. And that means retention, making sure that the users stick to using your product. So for me, I have a more holistic definition than growth. And I think that I don't like the limitative definition of growth where we define growth as being performance marketing only.
Very, very interesting. You've worked 10 years in tech. So linked to this, I want to ask you, what do you see the trends of growth marketing in tech companies nowadays?
So I think there's a huge debate. If I'm talking about growth marketing nowadays, there's a huge debate between product-led growth and marketing-driven growth. And from my experience, I don't understand why the fights, the internal fights between the teams, because it's not even a chicken or the egg question, because product always comes first. The question is not whether we shall have a product-driven growth strategy or a marketing-driven growth strategy. The challenge is how we can combine both in order to achieve hyper-growth for the product that we work on.
Very interesting that you mentioned product-led growth, because this is my field, and I feel like sometimes when I'm asked about my role, it's hard to define because I work in a startup in tech. So everything we do is related, obviously, to maintaining and updating the product so we are able to offer more features and also more product lines to users. So it is, like you said, product always comes first in any interaction. But it's very interesting to see how the growth side is also becoming more and more popular to evolve in, because, you know, you can do different experiments. You can look at, you know, different market fluctuations and decide, okay, this is the right moment to do this strategy or the other strategy. So I think it's a very interesting field to be in nowadays. And I would be curious to know your thoughts on how do you think the growth marketing field will evolve in the next few years?
So I think that we're seeing more and more people. I don't like to make predictions. I think that reality is always very, very different. I don't think we're able to actually foresee. I like the fact that there is an entire growth industry right now. I think that the startups ecosystem is maturing, and now we see growth as a profession. We see growth professionalizing. Back in the days, people that were doing growth were the growth hackers, who are basically the pirates that were experimenting around, doing everything and nothing. We couldn't actually define the profession, what they were working on. On my side, I think that the growth is product marketing all along the funnel. And I think that we're going to see growth professionalizing in the future, with more and more people gaining experience, because a couple of years ago, you couldn't find people that had experience in the field beyond the a bunch of growth hackers that were on the market. So I see an industry that is growing, that is professionalizing, that is learning and evolving.
That's very great to hear, because of course, like you said, becoming the role itself becoming more professional looking also helps industries understand, okay, we need this sort of role within our company, you know, in the next year or so, or even before that, in order to create this product market setup where both teams work together and they strive for the same thing. So, of course, it's super interesting to hear also your thoughts on how it will evolve. Obviously, I've prepared a couple of questions about your experience with Uber and with Revolut. Both of them startups, originally startups that became multi-million, billion dollar companies, and you've joined to grow and evolve the business in Central Eastern Europe, and more specifically, you've joined for Uber for Romania for some time. Can you tell us more about your path in building the marketing team for Uber? I remember it was a huge, I thought at the time it was like a huge accomplishment when I saw it on your LinkedIn, and obviously you grew from there, but I would be curious to, you know, understand more about what were your initial ideas to start growing the team, and also what are you most proud of during the time at Uber?
So I think that the most proud of I'm the most proud of my team and what we've managed to accomplish together. I'm a firm believer in lean teams. So I oftentimes see the mistake when people are defining some roles in an org structure and trying to hire for those open roles instead of looking at results and what are we trying to accomplish. I'm a firm believer in lean teams. I think that one thing that we should learn better, particularly in the tech startups world, is that we have a responsibility for the people that we hire and that we bring in the team. So we need to be very careful when hiring in order to make sure that we actually need the person that we're hiring. And not only that, but we're hiring right and we're hiring the right person for the role. Because if you hire wrong, the responsibility, it's not only a negative impact over your company, it's also a negative impact over the life of the individual that you're hiring. So I'm a firm believer in lean teams. I'm always looking first at our objectives. What are we trying to accomplish? Based on what we are trying to accomplish, we're looking at what types of competencies we need within the team, what's the skill set that we need within the team, and what's the bandwidth that we currently have in the team. Because I make the decision to hire new persons in two instances. We have a skill set gap, so we need we need to grow, and we've identified that one of the growth major growth levers that we wanna explore over the next month years is business development, is strategic partnerships, and we have a skill gap because we don't have a very, very strong business developer within the team. And then I hire a person in order to fill that role. And the second instance when I choose to hire and to make a new hire is when we are at capacity, because I oftentimes see overworked teams, and overworked teams are not effective. They are not a sign of commitment, of determination, of passion. They are a sign of improper management. So if my team is overworked and we've reached our bandwidth, we're hiring new people in order to expand our capacity and be able to do more. I think it's things are getting more and more complicated as our teams grow, because back at Uber, I've built quite a small team. While during my time at Revolut, I was building a very, very large team. And in a large team, things are not that easy. But then you need to build layers of mid management, in intermediary layers of management in order to help you out. And with the right principles and with the right management in place, you're going to succeed to build an effective team.
A lot of learnings in 2 minutes, and I hope that I will listen to this many times, create many sound bites, so everybody gets to hear this very, very valuable advice. We can all hear that you're very passionate about your work, and I was curious to know what is the main learning from being given this opportunity that obviously for some sounds different, but for me, the fact that you have the opportunity to build Uber's, practice in a country, it's really a lot of work. What is your main learning from having that opportunity?
I learned so many things. I don't think I can nail it to one. I grew myself as a professional very much during my time at Uber. So I think that one of the biggest learnings is that you need to have the right manager in place. You need to have the right mentors in place. I was very, very lucky to have an incredibly talented manager that guided my steps at Uber and helped me grow as a professional and helped me grow as a human being in the same time. I think I learned that I'm never as good individually as my team is. So basically, together we're better than each of us individually. And I think this was one of the major learnings, because any type of strategy, I'm always involving my team in building the strategy, because any type of strategy that you build by yourself is not going to be as good as the type of strategy you build if you involve multiple brains in the process, and the pie is bigger than the sum of its parts. So I've learned to work collaboratively and to involve all of the team in the process. I've learned to never assume anything, and I know that this might sound like a cliche, but oftentimes you tend to believe that you know the answer, and the truth is you know nothing. The only ones that know the answer are your users. So I've talked a lot with the users in order to find the answers I was looking for. And after a bunch of epic fails, I learned never to assume that I know the answer, and never to assume that because I'm using the product, I'm having all the answers about the product.
Very, very wise. Also mentioning the users in this scenario, because it is key to ask your user base, what do you think about what we are building here? Is it really something that you would want to use? Is it really something that will help you, will bring value? Is it going to solve your problems? And obviously, sometimes when we are so busy with making business plans and strategies, we forget to ask the users, what do they think about all of the things we build? So, yeah.
One more thing that that I just remembered right now, and I think that one of the key learnings was on the personal side, was to learn to focus on what moves the needle. And I've seen this, and particularly in the tech world, I see a lot of people being busy with being busy. I see a lot. It's like, you know, the hamster in the wheel metaphor. You're running like a hamster in a wheel, and you're afraid to stop because the wheel is going to going to stop, but you're not making any type of progress. And I've learned to be very fierce in prioritizing, to respect my time and my team's time, and to work closely with the team in order to make them drop everything that's irrelevant and focus only on what moves the needle, and make the tough decisions, because oftentimes the projects you're working on are very dear to you and you fall in love with those projects. But some of the projects might not get you, you can be passionate about them, you can love them, but they aren't the right ones to help you reach your objectives. And then no matter how hard it is, you just have to drop them.
Yeah, prioritizing, it's extremely difficult, especially when you have limited resources. But what would you say is, what do you give as advice when people struggle with prioritizing, prioritization?
So we worked on a prioritization metrics, and I'm using that with my team whenever I see them struggling. So we have very clear KPIs. Here is where we want to get. My objective is the following. So we work on setting the KPIs together, but how you actually reach the KPI, it's up to you, because you know better than I do. So whenever I see people in my team that are getting swamped, we're working on a prioritization metric. So I'm asking them to do a brain dump, to do a list with everything, all the projects, all the major initiatives they are working on, as well as their time commitment. How much time are they investing in that project? And then we work on a scale. So it's highly impactful, it has medium impact, or it has little impact towards hitting the KPIs. And then we look at that, and everything that's low impact, high time commitment, it's out. Everything that's low impact, it's out. And then you stick, it's math, really. Like you stick with the initiatives that are actually driving you forward.
Yeah, teamwork. It seems like you have somehow nailed the setup, at least theoretically. I know in practice it's way harder, but at least theoretically, it seems like there is a very nice flow. I hope the listeners will use this in their prioritization setup. I want to move into Revolut, because that was really a big thing. And then you grew into an international role within, you know, growing the Central Eastern Europe team, which is absolutely fantastic, right? You probably had a lot of experiences, but I want to ask you, what did your role entail the first time you started at Revolut?
So I joined Revolut as to lead the Revolut operation on the Romanian market, so as country manager for Romania. The initial KPI was to get from 20,000 users to 100,000 users by the end of the year, with no local team. I was working with a distributed team and no marketing budget whatsoever. So it was a KPI that was crazy enough for me, and I really wanted to see if we managed to do it.
Wow. And then is it, how did you reach 100K by the end of the year?
Yes, we hit 150K.
Wow. Well, that's something that then moved forward to the next part of your role. Because can you tell us more about your experience becoming a regional leader in Central Eastern Europe? How did that happen? And what do you think was really a learning or some sort of milestone for you to reach that that situation, that role?
So in a nutshell, so I started as country manager for Romania, and we hit the KPI, and talking about, we talked in the beginning about product-led growth and marketing-driven growth. And I do believe there's one missing link in this entire equation, and that's community-driven growth. Because I think that what actually gets you the network effect in order to reach hyper-growth is neither product-driven growth, which is limited in terms of the growth that it can deliver, nor marketing-driven growth, where you actually pay for the users. So you have product-driven growth with where you're communicating with users on the own channels, and then you have marketing-driven growth where you have the paid channels, the paid media. But there is a missing link in between, and that's community-driven growth, and that's earned channels, and that's building a love brand, and that's building a strong community around your product and turning your users into growth vectors for the product. So I've been working on that part for for my first 8 months at Revolut. And then I remember that we were talking about the fact that what got us here won't take us there. And in order to further grow, we need a different org structure. So I started brainstorming with our leadership team back then at about org structures that would allow us to further grow and reach our true potential in the markets where we operate. And this is how we came up with the idea, completely non-revolutionary idea, of building a proper growth department. And I ended up project managing what we called our growth machine, which is basically a fancy name for our efforts of building the growth department and hiring growth teams at in Europe and in our expansion markets. And I've done that up until the very day I gave birth. And then I was promoted to lead the CE region, so Romania and the markets in the region. And exactly 1 year later, I was promoted again to lead our global growth department. So the department that we've started building in the in early 2019.
Wow! And I mean, that's really fantastic. Can you tell us what do you think would be a piece of advice for anyone that listens and wants to create this opportunity for themselves? Or do you think you created this opportunity because of your good results, because of the growth machine you built locally? What do you think really propelled you to this role?
So I think I never thought about getting promoted. I never thought about, like, I don't believe in building a career path and doing whatever it takes to go on that career path and climb up the career ladder and the corporate ladder and the startup ladder or whatever ladder. I think what's very, very important is to actually care about what you do. I think it's very important to be an owner, to be a true owner, and do everything. So one of the lessons, and that this comes from childhood, and my father was always telling me that the work that you do does not tell anything about the fact that you have a stupid teacher or a stupid employer. The work that you do tells something about yourself and yourself only. So as long as you strive to do the best possible work, as long as you care about the work that you do and you're an owner, you're going to get promoted. You're going to get more opportunities, and a lot of doors are going to open for you. But that's not the objective in itself. The objective is to do the best possible work and to enjoy the process. The process while you're doing it. Because if you have a job that you hate and you believe that when you're going to get promoted, things are going to change, no, they are just going to get worse and worse and worse. So if you have a job that you hate, just change it.
Yeah, it's really wise to hear that, because I did have an episode where we discussed about planning your career. So actually knowing that every 2 years you do have an opportunity to scale up within the corporate ladder. And I thought it was also full of many, many pieces of advice that were very relevant for that industry and obviously that setup that some corporates create. So I think it's very interesting.
So I think I think it depends a lot. Personally, I don't believe in career planning. I mean, it's very. I was talking a couple of weeks ago with a friend who's also a mom, and she was asking me how did I plan my career. And the truth is, I didn't plan anything in my career, and I'm not planning to do any proper. I'm not planning to do any planning, pun intended, going forward. I'm just planning to work on opportunities that I find exciting and that I love, and to do the best possible work. And I'm sure that opportunities are going to come. I have to admit that I'm not very familiar with the corporate environment and how things go over there. But I feel it can be relatable.
Yeah, for sure. Especially the part where you've mentioned, you know, owning what you work on, because the moment you are passionate about your work, everybody notices it. And it's not really something that will go unnoticed unless you are really in the wrong place at the wrong time and nobody really cares about your work. But most times it's really rewarded. And for you, this also meant going to a global role and really focusing on growing that. And I have a question related to that. If you were to define one thing that dramatically changed in your life in the period where you became a global leader, what would that be?
I don't think, I think it was the transition. I think the transitions were very different in, were very difficult in my career. So first it was the transition from being an individual contributor to being a manager. So I've always been in love with my work, very passionate about the work, and hence I enjoy spending quality time with my laptop. And it was very difficult when my team got quite big. And I spent most of my week managing people instead of doing work. And I remember that I had like an enlightening moment when my Uber manager told me, I was complaining and I was like, I'm in meetings all day. I'm in one-on-ones and I'm managing people all day. I actually want to work. And she smiled at me and she told me like, you're going to be much more relaxed when you're going to understand that managing people is work as well. So I think that that was on the one side, and then the second big transition was transitioning from being a manager to being an executive, because as an executive, your role is no longer not even to manage people directly, because the team is so big that you don't have direct exposure to all the people within your team, but understanding that my role is just to be a resource for my team. Is to build processes, is to make sure that I remove all the bottlenecks that my teams face and to act as a resource for my teams, help them solve problems.
Wow, it's really, really great that you've also noticed those three, four different key points of being really an executive, because oftentimes we wonder, okay, we know that executives do not reach teams to the same extent that a manager will ever do. That's why you also mentioned that while growing a marketing setup, you decided to put on middle managers, right? In order to continue to have this sort of decentralized way of handling work. But more importantly, like you said, when you become an executive, you become a resource yourself. So people come to you to solve their problems in order to continue to work on the business and be successful. And that is definitely something interesting to hear from you also as advice, to kind of have this mindset of, once you reach a certain level, you need to focus on how you can give back in a way that you haven't done it before. And people will not need your individual contribution in terms of writing a blog post or doing some sort of email exchange with distributors. It will be really high level and discussing processes and bottlenecks. So thanks a lot for covering that. It's really fun to also hear it from you, how it went and your thought process. Dealing with challenging situations. So you obviously had a storm of a career with so many opportunities, and I'm really excited to discuss them in depth. How do you approach challenging situations, though? Because obviously that happens. And what do you advise listeners who go through challenging situations to consider and be aware of?
So I think that's I'm laughing because I see myself as a problem lover. So I'm drawn to the biggest problem, and I'm actually getting very, very excited when things are complicated or challenging, because this means that you also have the opportunity to get a solution. I've not always been like that. I used to stress out during challenging situations and turn things on all sides and everything. And this is a great improvement I've done with myself. So whenever I have a challenging situation, first I apply a very simple framework, which is again learned from my manager at Uber. And I was always asking her. So I was stressing a lot. I don't know, taxi strike, protests, policy issues, weather things, and I was stressing a lot about them. And I asked her, how on earth, I at some point initially when we started working together, I thought that, I mean, how can you be so composed if you do care? And I actually suspected that she doesn't care. And I asked her, how do you do it? So how aren't you stressing out? And she told me, so the framework is simple. We have a problem. Yes. Okay. Then what's the solution? we don't have a solution, then we don't have a problem. It's just a status quo and we'll learn to live with it. So I'm approaching everything with this framework now, and it helped me get very, very thick skinned in time. So, it's a challenging situation, but can we actually do something to change it? Because if not, let's adapt to it and learn to live with it. And you build resilience in time when going through it. And if we do have a solution, I'm just looking at, so I'm using again a very simple framework. So this is the problem, these are the potential solution, each of the potential solution has advantages and disadvantages. So no solution you choose is going to be perfect, but I'm making an informed choice. So I'm evaluating all the alternative solutions, I'm making an informed choice, and I'm sticking with it. And if the choice that I made is uncomfortable, and it proves not to be the best one, I revisit the options and I go to another solution. But I'm not stressing over this.
When it comes to actually managing stressful situations, because what you said is great, but it's very difficult for many people to implement and think about, okay, it's just the status quo, we'll just go with it, run with it for now, and see when a solution arrives or when the problem has an actual plan to consider in order to solve it.
Resilience is built. So you build resilience in time and with exercise and telling yourself that. And the more challenging the work that you do is, the more challenges you have, the better you get in managing the challenges.
So you do advise people to don't shy away from being in challenging situations where you learn.
Yes, definitely. Yes. And I think we shall all step outside the comfort zone. I think it. I mean, it's very easy to say stepping outside the comfort zone. But I mean, you get to a point when you actually get comfortable when getting outside the comfort zone. I mean, you're embracing the unknown, you're embracing the challenges, and you can only get good at it, and you can only build resilience if you're training yourself through this.
Very, very good point. Yeah, definitely. It's
like with running. Nobody runs a marathon from the beginning.
On the first try.
Yeah.
True. Very, very.
And
true.
The more you run, the better you get at running.
Definitely. Yeah. It's a very good point to consider that things don't just come. You need to also build this resilience in time and take the time to go through these challenging situations, find solutions, and next time you'll be better at managing it. Very, very well said.
One more thing here is don't stress about things that you cannot change, and don't look backwards. So one thing is certain, you're not going to be able to change the past. So if you can't change it, just don't worry about that. Asking yourself, what would have happened if I would have taken a different choice at the point, it's counterproductive, because you're never going to know.
It's very true. And it's very real that it happens to many people. And sometimes I tell myself, is this a situation that I can control in any way? No, I cannot control the situation. So what am I doing stressing about it? It's really something you cannot really control.
I think it's very important to actually focus on the things that are in our control, because otherwise we're getting so anxious and so stressed out, worrying about things that we can't do anything about.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I am happy you've mentioned that now, because my next question is about well-being and dealing with career and challenges throughout your professional path. How do the two work hand in hand, career and well-being? And what did you discover about yourself in the process of managing and balancing this two?
So I think I'm going to say something that's not very, very inspirational. We can't have it all. And I'm not talking that you, I'm not telling that you either have a career or you have a family or you go to the gym or whatever. I'm telling that we need to have, we need to make some informed choices, and it's going you're going to have some to make some sacrifices along the way, because your day only has 24 hours. So whenever whenever you choose to do something, you're doing it at the expense of some other thing. So the question is, what are the most valuable things for you in order to stick them in the 24 hours? So I think it's doable to have, I think there's no such thing as a universal recipe for work-life balance. I think that that balance is a very individual balance, and each one of us, every one of us knows exactly what the right balance is for them and feels what's the balance for them. So I think that on one side, it's very important to understand that you can't have it all, to understand that you need to prioritize the things that you put into your day, and then to pick the things that are the most important for you and give up others, of course. I think that the problem and the real struggle is because we don't want to give up anything. For me, I think the most difficult moment was when I became a mom, because you can't stay all the time with your kid and work full time in the same time. It's impossible because you don't have that bandwidth. So you have to make some choices, and then it's the guilt that you're not spending enough time with your kid. If I'm looking at my my time as being both a full time employee and a full time mom. I think I made an aware decision that I'm not going to. I did that at the expense of the time for myself, because I didn't have I didn't have enough hours in the day. So forgot about doing things for myself, and it was an informed decision. So I choose to work and I choose to spend time with kiddo, and I'm not going to have a lot of time to go out with my friends, for example, or to go to the gym, because there aren't as many hours in a day. I think that we're portraying a lot of idyllic idyllic images of work-life balance where, I'm a mother of four, have a full-time job, I'm an executive in a big startup, I'm going to the gym three times per week, spending the nights with my husband, and going out with my friends three times per week. That doesn't exist. That's a myth.
Well, already having a full-time job and going out with your friends three times a week, it's something that doesn't happen nowadays anyway. So, you know, it's very interesting that you mention it, because like you said, we do have idyllic portrayals of how work-life balance look like. And I do live in a country where work-life balance is discussed. And parents do go home to pick up their kids at 3:34 after a day of school. And then they work after if they need to cover anything. And everybody accepts it. And everybody is okay with that. And there are no discussions around that. And I wonder, did you feel stressed about that situation in any way?
So on one side, my kid, I think I have a lot of support. First of all, I'm raising this kid together with my husband, and we were both very involved, so we covered for each other. Secondly, we have a lot of help, so we have a nanny that helps us out with raising the kid. We have our parents that are helping us out as well, so I got a lot of help and support here. Secondly, my kid was quite young. When the world was still normal, and then the pandemic hit. So that eliminated all the time lost in traffic, all the time lost in planes. And I did actually manage to get more time in order to both work and stay with him. But no, for me, it's non-negotiable. So for example, putting my kiddo to bed every evening, it's non-negotiable. So I always took a break.
Yeah, I heard about the non-negotiables when we were discussing, you know, managing your situation at home, especially in the setup of having kids that are young enough to actually need, obviously, support throughout the day. And I think it was a really big struggle for many parents the last year and a half, where things were just so surreal.
Yes, that's the. I mean, working from home with a toddler, it's completely completely insane, because he wants you and he cries for you, and he sometimes enters the room and enters a call or shouts or stuff like that. But I think that people have become more understandable to that. And on another hand side, we were talking about, for me, kids' bedtime is non-negotiable. Everything can be non-negotiable. I mean, your yoga sessions can be non-negotiable. Everything can be. It's just you that has to actually set those limits and understand what's important for you.
Definitely. I'm happy you've mentioned other activities, because I was about to say that if there was one thing I discovered in the last year, it's definitely on one side, what are my non-negotiables when it comes to well-being, and figuring out that I actually didn't give myself a lot of time just to think or just to be with myself, and I was always involved. It was very interesting to see what a difference it makes when you say no. In the beginning, it was very hard to say no, extremely hard to say no. I felt guilty in many situations. But then out of a sudden, you kind of realize that you're doing it for yourself, right? So you are the creator of your own setup. And if you choose that the setup is this, then you're just going to communicate that to whoever needs to know and whoever is interested to be part of that setup, right? So very happy that you've mentioned it as well, because it is a struggle, and I'm also thankful we got this hour to go through it and discuss a bit about it.
I think it's very important to just understand it's exactly the prioritization framework that I was talking about with my team. You can apply that in your personal life as well. So what are your objectives? So, okay, you want to shine at your job, or you want to get to spend time with your family, and you want the time for yourself. Those three things were and are key for me. So whenever an opportunity comes up, a call proposal comes up and everything, it's up to you to look at what are your objective, and whether that answering that email, will it get you closer to your objective or not? Because if not, okay, just forget about or just being polite. Don't do things just for being polite and for saying that, oh, I'm so nice that I answer all the messages that I receive or take all the calls that I calls that I get. Just look at your objective and understand to what extent that doing that thing takes you closer to your objectives or not.
Definitely, definitely. Very, very well said. I do want to ask you, summing up, I have one, two questions for you, but I do want to ask you, what was the biggest surprise of your career so far?
So I don't know. I think there were a lot of surprises. Like I think every time I got promoted at Uber, at Revolut as well, it came as a surprise for me. So I wasn't expecting that. As I was telling you, I wasn't working towards a promotion. Never worked towards a promotion. So it always came as a surprise for me. I had people that surprised me, both in a very, very positive way, and I was very happy to see them grow. I was very happy to promote them, to give them more opportunities. And in the negative sense, with people that failed to deliver or failed to comply. So I think these were some of the surprises in my career.
Yeah,
I used to say that I've seen so many things that nothing surprises me, but that's not true. I think I'm surprised every day by something or some other thing.
Thank you so much, Irina, for covering that. Okay, summing up, Irina, looking back, what do you wish you knew 5 years ago?
That everything is going to be okay.
Sounds so nice.
I think that I stressed out a lot. I was very anxious. I burnt out twice. And I think that I wish I'd known that everything is going to be okay. I need to work smarter, not harder. I need to respect myself and my time, because if I don't do that, nobody else will. So I think these are the things that I wish I knew back, maybe not 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, but still.
Thank you so much, Irina. It was really lovely to talk to you. I think, you know, within 40 minutes, we covered so much ground and you've given so many good pieces of advice. So thanks a lot for covering them. Thank you for joining us here at FemLead. And thank you for what you do. And I hope that this sabbatical will really give you the time to recharge.
Thanks a lot for having me here. And I'm sorry it took so much in order to actually get together and register this.
Thank you very much, Ina. And thank you all for joining us today. Stay tuned for more amazing interviews with female role models. I hope you felt inspired to take charge of your next career move. Remember to review this podcast and share your comments. Thank you.